much, Ewan. Hey, I'm back. My name is Tom. I didn't introduce myself before. I'm one of the leaders here. Now, some of you may remember a news story from a few years back, and it involves one of the biggest and most trusted car companies in the world. They were caught in a huge scandal. Now, for years, Volkswagen had marketed their diesel cars as clean, efficient, and environmentally friendly. Their adverts showed, what, happy families driving around clean countryside and fields. Political leaders praised the company, calling them pioneers of low-emission technology. People bought vehicles on the basis of making an eco-friendly purchase. But then, a small university research team in West Virginia University, of all places, noticed something odd. They were measuring the emissions of vehicles both in lab and real-world driving situations. And in the lab, the cars produced these amazing, great results, matching the factory figures. But in real-world conditions, they were polluting up to 40 times more than the legal limit. Why did this happen? Well, it turns out that engineers in the company had written a clever bit of software that enabled the car's computer to detect when it was being tested, and it kicked in a bit of programming to temporarily make the engine run cleaner. And this would disengage as soon as the car returned to normal driving conditions. So what happened? Well, first VW denied it, then they tried to downplay it. But eventually, the truth rang out, and it was one of the biggest scandals in automotive industry. They paid billions of fines globally. Senior leaders were sacked, and perhaps most damaging of all, they lost trust. They lost the trust of the public. You see, when you're hiding the truth, crafting a web of falsehood, one lie often leads to another. You have to keep patching holes, spinning further lies, making excuses, and eventually everything collapses. Now we're going to see something like this in our passage from the Bible today. We are nearly done with Matthew's gospel. It's 3 years next week. This passage is a bit different. It doesn't feature Jesus or indeed any of the characters that we've really come to know. This is a bit of a behind-the-scenes peek. Now, I'm going to set the scene here. It's Easter morning, and Jesus' tomb is empty. The women who had come to the tomb heard from the angel that Jesus has risen. The Roman soldiers who were guarding the tomb were so terrified that they fainted. But instead of facing the inevitable truth, the religious leaders in Jerusalem invent a cover-up. They bribe the soldiers, they spin a story, but as often happens, the cover-up only makes the truth more obvious. So let's listen as Evelyn comes up to read our passage for us.
Here you go. It's page 1000 of Church Bible, and Matthew 28:11-15. While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day.
Thanks very much, Evelyn. If you've not been with us for the past few weeks, it might be worth briefly catching up. Jesus has been betrayed by his disciple Judas. He's been abandoned by the rest of his followers, disciples that is, and he's been condemned to death through an unjust trial. The colonial Roman government was in charge of executions, and they carried out Jesus' execution by crucifixion. David's talk 2 weeks ago introduced us to Joseph of Arimathea, a wealthy Jewish man who was an admirer of Jesus, who provided space in his family tomb for Jesus' body. Last week, Ed took us through the account of Jesus' resurrection, that core moment of truth for Christians throughout history. Like the Creed says, Jesus suffered under Pontius Pilate, died, and was buried, and 3 days later, he rose from the dead. And this isn't an ordinary burial. If you look back to verse 63, the Jewish leaders go to Pilate and they say, "Sir, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver, that is Jesus, said, 'After 3 days, I will rise again.' Pilate orders the tomb sealed and sends a company of soldiers to stand guard." It's such an odd picture to our modern perspective, isn't it? Grave robbery was definitely a factor in the ancient world. It's a very dark and candlelit grave there. What's the deal with grave robbery? It's usually because wealthy individuals in many ancient Near Eastern religious contexts were often buried along with their stuff. Think of something like the pharaohs, who would fill their tombs with gold, artwork, food, even their favorite pets, to have company in the afterlife. Well, they didn't get to enjoy them in the way they imagined, but they did succeed in propping up an industry of grave robbers. But what we've got in our passage is an altogether different matter. The Jewish leaders believe that they need to stop Jesus' followers from raiding the tomb, stealing his body, and by this ruse, convincing everyone that Jesus was raised from the dead. But look what actually happens. According to Matthew, there's a huge earthquake. An angel turns up and rolls the stone away. It's worth, incidentally, reminding ourselves that angels aren't the cute and cuddly figurines that we sometimes see on the top of Christmas trees. If you ever go to certain Christian bookstore chains, they look kind of like that, cute and cuddly, right? But that's not how the Bible shows them. They're scary. The typical response of humans in the Bible encountering angels is one of abject fear, something more like that. Look what Matthew says in verse 3 of the chapter. His appearance was like lightning. His clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid that they shook and became like dead men. Something a bit more like Thor there. Now, for reference, Roman soldiers were about as tough as people got in the ancient world. The first century Roman poet Virgil preserves this for us in the Aeneid. He says, "Your task, Roman, and do not forget it, will be to govern the peoples of the world in your empire. These will be your arts, and to impose a settled pattern upon peace, to pardon the defeated, and war down the proud." Just picture Russell Crowe kind of standing there intimidating people, right? Roman soldiers were efficient, calculated, violent killing machines. They were unflinching, disciplined, and deadly. And that's why our passage today would have been incredibly shocking to someone reading in Matthew's day. It seems a bit ridiculous, doesn't it? They had one job. All they had to do was prevent a bunch of fishermen and tax collectors from stealing their dead leader's body. Or so they thought. Then they see this terrifying angel whose arrival is preceded by an earthquake, and they run for the hills after falling like dead men. We have to remember, they've quite literally fled their post. Given what I've said about the Roman army thus far, you can certainly imagine that they don't have the most patient and understanding bosses. Military discipline was incredibly harsh in the ancient world. If we look to the book of Acts, which tells us the history of the earliest days of the church, we see when Peter escapes from the jail, his guards are killed as a result. At another point in Acts, the Apostle Paul and his companion Silas are imprisoned. God causes their chains to miraculously fall off, and the guard is shown to be about to take his own life for fear of what will happen to him if his superiors were to find out that there was a jailbreak on his watch. So these guys are in a pretty impossible scenario. I mean, imagine being one of these soldiers. You're trained for battle. You're trained never to flinch, and suddenly you're absolutely overcome and flat on your back like a dead man. The soldiers report what's happened to the Jewish leaders rather than Pilate. This might seem a bit strange, but remember that Pilate has functionally assigned these soldiers to work for the Jewish leaders. So in reality, they're actually due the first report. And as you might imagine, it draws up quite a stir within the upper ranks of Jewish leadership. Which leads to our second point. What are the leaders going to do with the information they've received? What will they make of it? If we were coming to this story completely fresh, we might be tempted to lean into a bit of hope. Maybe this is what they needed to stop stubbornly rejecting that Jesus was who he said he was, the Messiah, their promised deliverer. Maybe the fact that this event is so unquestionably supernatural, angels who looked like they were dressed in lightning, terrifying the scary, tough Roman soldiers so much that they passed out. Surely this could be the event that finally caused them to see the truth. But as we see in the passage, it doesn't sink in. They double down on their presuppositions about Jesus. And as an aside, how telling are these various responses to this event? The soldiers feared, the women worshipped, and the Jewish leaders devised a plan. We'll come back to that thought in a minute. What's going on here? If we're going to get a good understanding of the leadership's approach, we need to pull back a little bit and look at the response of Jewish leaders to Jesus throughout his ministry. If we go back through Matthew's gospel, we see Jesus exorcising demons, that is, driving them out of people who were being physically and spiritually tormented. Matthew chapter 9 shows Jesus helping a demon-possessed man who couldn't talk. The crowd is astonished, or at least most of the crowd is astonished. Verse 34 says that the Pharisee said it's by the prince of demons that he drives out a demon. A few chapters later, in Matthew 12, it happens again. Jesus heals a young man who's been rendered both blind and mute by a demon. The crowd is astonished, except for the lone outliers, the Pharisees. This time they don't just say that he's in league with the prince of demons, they directly connect him with Beelzebul, which literally means the lord of the flies or the lord of filth. Either way, it's essentially Jewish shorthand for Satan himself. When I preached on this last year, I think it was a bit like them saying, he who must not be named. So here's what I really want to highlight. Throughout Jesus' ministry, the Jewish leaders were convinced that Jesus' ministry was supernatural. Their opposition to him throughout his life was entirely consistent with a response to someone who they believed was not just teaching wrong ideas, but channeling supernatural power. And here's the implication. If Jesus' power was supernatural, he was achieving feats through the power of Satan. Now, Jesus, in these earlier passages in Matthew, easily demolishes the Pharisees' argument, but nevertheless, they seem to stick with that charge throughout the rest of his ministry. I think that's what's going on here. The New Testament scholar Michael Wilkins puts it this way. We need to remember that they, that is the Jewish leaders, truly believe Jesus' ministry is satanically empowered, and they undoubtedly think that they are doing the right thing in preventing what they believe to be another satanically empowered event to deceive the people. The Pharisees spent much of Jesus' life in ministry opposing Jesus, trying to connect him with sorcery and satanic power. But what's particularly interesting is that in his death, they're confronted by one final, unquestionably supernatural account of Jesus. This time, however, the story is not retold by skeptical Jews, but by scared soldiers. If there's ever a point to look to one another and begin to admit, we were wrong about Jesus, this was it. And yet, Matthew says they meet together with the elders and devised a story, a suspicious story. Look what Matthew writes in verse 12. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a sum of money, telling them, you are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. What do you make of this plan? His disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. Well, we've already noticed that the guards admitting to fall asleep is an unlikely story. The guards are pros. They don't fall asleep on duty. It's an occupational hazard for a soldier. Furthermore, it does really sound likely that less than a dozen fishermen and tax collectors could roll away this giant stone from the entrance of the tomb without waking up these allegedly sleeping soldiers. What's more, if the soldiers were asleep, how can they say that it was the disciples who took his body? By definition, they should have no idea who took a body like that. Finally, what has the track record of Jesus' disciples been? They abandoned him following his arrest, and they scattered. They've not demonstrated bravery in the face of threat. In fact, the only people who have stuck by Jesus the whole time is a group of women. How interesting and how revolutionary that it's not the disciples, the inner circle, who first are told about the resurrection and first tell people about the resurrection. It's this small group of women who have remained faithful and close to Jesus throughout the weekend. Needless to say, this plan on the Pharisees and Jewish leaders' part has a few weak points throughout, and ultimately it only works if the Roman soldiers are going to make themselves look ridiculous, incapable, and inept. But the Jewish leaders are ready for that, and they've anticipated it before the soldiers could even point it out. Look at verse 14. They say, if this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. The American theologian Stanley Hauerwas has a helpful observation on this point. He writes, the chief priests and elders seem to realize, however, that they have not developed a convincing story concerning the empty tomb. One lie leads to another lie, less believable than the original lie. So they reassure the soldiers to whom they've offered the bribe that if news of the disappearance of Jesus' body comes to the ears of the governor, they will satisfy him and keep them out of trouble. And the implication seems to be that they will also pay off the governor. You see, the thing about lies, you can't just tell one. Falsehood needs to be cultivated, protected, actively maintained in order to keep the illusion that it means to show. In devising this ridiculous story and inviting the soldiers to be co-conspirators, the Jewish leaders are not simply stubbornly denying truth. They're actively sowing falsehood. I mentioned somewhat in jest that the soldiers had one job, making sure nobody went into the tomb. But there's also a sense in which the Jewish leaders also only had one job. Their job was to watch for and recognize the coming Messiah, who's going to transform and deliver God's people. And the thing is, they fail spectacularly. This isn't just something that happens at the end of Matthew's gospel. It's happened right at the beginning as well. Remember King Herod slaughtering babies throughout the kingdom so that he could prevent the arrival of one who would be greater than him. Remember the various times in Jesus' ministry where he was cornered and interrogated by various Jewish groups. They weren't only trying to discredit him, they were actively trying to lure him into incriminating himself so that they would have grounds to call for his execution. Commentator Michael Wilkins sums the story up rather well when he writes, why then do the religious leaders concoct such a dubious story? And why do the guards agree to be implicated for negligence of duty? The religious leaders are desperate and want to hide what has happened. The guards are likewise in a predicament. If they accept the plan of the Jewish religious leaders, they are putting themselves in jeopardy because they have allowed the security of the tomb to be breached. They cannot deny that the tomb is empty, and who would believe them about some angelic being? Additionally, they failed to put up a fight. Either way, therefore, they face possible execution for dereliction of duty. Thus, with the backing of the Jewish religious leaders, they have at least a chance to escape punishment. And the religious leaders see in their proposal a crafty way of accounting for the empty tomb. In a sense, and by way of conclusion, there's nothing new going on here, at least on part of the Jewish leaders. What's interesting is that if we go back to Matthew 12, which we looked at earlier, where Jesus was confronted by the Pharisees for performing an exorcism, they make their dubious claims, and what does Jesus say? I tell you that everyone will have to give account on the day of judgment for every empty word they have spoken. For by your words you will be acquitted, and by your words you will be condemned. We can see a picture of this in the response of the various groups to Jesus' resurrection. By my count, there are three perspectives we can consider. The women, who trusted Jesus and for whom the resurrection confirmed their greatest hope. The Jewish leaders, for whom the mere idea of Jesus' resurrection represented their greatest fears. And finally, the Roman soldiers, whose concern largely seems to be for themselves. You see, I think this passage has something to say to all three, and indeed for all of us today. For those of you who are Christians, it's worth mentioning briefly that this passage, and particularly its ending, has sometimes been used as a justification for anti-Semitism, and that's used wrongly. I think we should actually see it much more as a warning to us. God's people were capable of profoundly failing to see and profoundly failing to support God's work in his world, to the degree that they opposed his son's ministry and were complicit in his death. Isn't it good news, then, that the Bible says that our failures don't have to be the end of the story, that Jesus' forgiveness and grace is bigger than our own blindness? For those of you who are undecided, maybe you're like the religious leaders and you're actively opposed to Jesus. Maybe you're like the Roman soldiers, you just don't know what to make of all you've seen. I know, believe me, that to stand up in a room full of thoughtful 21st century people and say that all of human experience hinges on the belief that a carpenter in Palestine was actually the Son of God who rose from the dead, it's a big pill to swallow. But can I also ask, have you actually dug in to the evidence yourself? My wife is a big Sherlock Holmes fan. And if you're familiar with the detective's method, he has this famous line, "When you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth." If you're dismissing the resurrection as impossible, are you really being more open-minded? Or are you just spinning your own cover story? Now, to that end, I've got a couple books on our little bookshelf that might be useful if you want to dig into these things. Dave actually ordered this one a couple weeks ago. It's called Who Moved the Stone by Frank Morrison. It's looking at it from a kind of legal perspective. Amy Orr Ewing's Why Trust the Bible is an excellent resource just to get your feet wet in these kind of things. We've also got A Doubter's Guide to Jesus, looking at these things from the perspective of an ancient historian. They're all on the shelf, as I kick the monitor. They're all on the shelf. They're all free. If you're interested, please take one with you. Of course, you're also very welcome to come talk to me, come talk to any of us. Please do explore this, because what you find could change your life. I've asked John to come up and lead us in a song of response that affirms these deep truths. I'd like to invite him back as we draw near to the end of Matthew. Let's stand and sing.